This started it all, at least in the U.S. Beatlemania.
You let me be your man, and please say to me, you let me hold your hand.
Screaming girls.
I was supposed to be there.
And then they hit that octave. This is it. And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. So which band was better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones? The debate springs eternal. The Beatles created worldwide hysteria among fans, and the Stones created more bluesy, gritty music. The Stones nucleus has been together for over 50 years, and the Beatles endured an emotional breakup. With us now is historian and music fan John McMillan. He's the author of Beatles vs. Stones and has researched the debate. He joins us now from station WKAR at Michigan State University. Welcome to you, John McMillan.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
We're going to have some fun tonight.
Yes, we are. Today.
Today. This afternoon.
By the way, is it McMillian or McMillan?
It's McMillan. Thanks for asking. You're not the first person to get it confused.
Okay, before we start, I just want to say we want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have a preference? We have set up a poll. Paul Leary set it up on our Facebook page. You can vote for either the Beatles or the Stones, and then Paul will give the results at the end of the program. So you go to Facebook / Topical Currents, and you can
Topical
vote.
Topical Currents Facebook.
Yeah,
Facebook.
Well, the Topical Currents Facebook page. Okay. All right, so now, John, or Professor, it's interesting to me because this really seems like more of a study in contrast than similarities, but so be it. Were the Beatles and Stones friends, rivals, or both?
I think it was a fair bit of both. You know, they certainly enjoyed each other's company, and they got along well most of the time, and they would tend to bond over a lot of their shared experiences as, you know, very popular rock stars. But then there was also a sense of competition. There was a sense of competition for record sales and also cultural influence and aesthetic credibility and all of these things. And even as they enjoyed each other's company, they never stopped trying to outperform each other. So I think it's best described as maybe a creative rivalry or a competitive friendship or something along those lines.
The Stones are always considered the more gritty, but actually they grew up in a more suburban setting in London. And the Beatles' backgrounds was in much more of a working-class environment in Liverpool.
That's right. I mean, there were some sort of class distinctions within both groups. And, you know, in post-World War II England, it was a very class-conscious and stratified society without a lot of social mobility. And in Liverpool, where the Beatles were from, they were, you know, mostly working-class kids. And they were looking at a life of very low prestige and low wage vocations if they had not been successful with the Beatles. And they were also troublemakers, you know, especially John Lennon more than the others.
Wasn't he born in a bomb shelter?
That's a myth.
That's a myth?
He said that himself, but he was either fibbing or confused. So that was found out by historians not to be true. He was actually, of the four Beatles, he was the one who was the most well off. And people are surprised to learn this sometimes, but of the four Beatles, John is the only one who grew up in a household with an indoor plumbing.
I was surprised to learn that Mick Jagger went to the London School of Economics.
Right. It's a very prestigious school.
Yes.
And he got in at a time when only about 2% of British kids even went on to any universities. And so he was well off. And then Brian Jones, who founded the Rolling Stones, he was an outstanding student. He also could have gone to a very selective school if he had wanted to. He chose not to. But Brian Jones and Mick Jagger were upper middle class kids from cosmopolitan London.
So given their socioeconomic differences and their educational differences, how was it that the Beatles presented as this clean cut, you know, these nice guys?
And they bowed after every song.
Yes, mm-hmm. Polite. And how was it that the Stones, who were from a much better situation, were the ones who were like the dirty guys or the bad boys?
Mm-hmm. A lot of it was marketing. The Beatles, of course, when they were first getting started, they were tough kids. They wore leather jackets. They sort of cut their teeth musically in Hamburg, Germany, and they lived a very debauched and lascivious lifestyle. But when they came across their manager, Brian Epstein, he persuaded them to conform and bow and be polite and get in these suits, and he cleaned up their stage act. When the Beatles were first getting going, they would literally eat food on stage and joke with each other and drink and smoke, you know, between songs. And of course, Brian Epstein put an end to all of that and portrayed the Beatles as these very lovable, amiable mop tops. And the Stones, you know, they were a bit different. They saw themselves as blues evangelists when they were first getting going. They were trying to popularize, you know, American electric blues. But then when they met their first manager, Andrew Oldham, he also convinced the Stones for a very brief period to wear suits and wear matching outfits, and he wanted the Stones to present themselves as natural successors to the Beatles, but that didn't really stick. And within just a couple months, the Stones reverted to being this more bohemian type group, and they cast off their matching outfits and portrayed themselves as a little more edgy and dangerous and impolite than the Beatles.
I remember when I was a kid, and Satisfaction first came out, and they had that fuzz box and that riff, bum, bum, ba, ba, bum. Maybe we can hear a little of that, Paul. Number 7. Young he sounds.
Yes.
Drum section.
You know, when I was getting the music for the program today, I, by mistake, clicked on a later version of Satisfaction, and of course, it's obvious, but it was jarring, the difference in his voice, in Mick Jagger's voice, from when was this recorded?
63?
No, I think a bit later. I want to say 64, 65, yeah.
Okay, and then this is 30 years later, and it made me think, why are they still performing? But I guess people still really love them. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, John, about the media, not just about how they fed into the rivalry, but also about how each group was portrayed by the media and each group's relationship with the media.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a very different media environment in England than we were accustomed to now. One thing that the British had was they had a very robust music press. So they had, you know, papers that were coming out every single week, and a lot of what they did was chart the success or failure of various groups relative to each other. So there are always these screeching and hyperbolic headlines saying one group is up and one group is down. And that fed the impression that groups were sort of at odds with each other, even if they were in fact friendly and so on. And so that had implications for the Beatles-Stones debate. But also the journalists back then were a lot more protective of the people they covered. And so the Beatles, in their off time, when they weren't out in public, were able to get away with all sorts of licentious and crude behavior that contradicted very much their image. But journalists, in order to in return for access, would agree not to report on certain things. They wouldn't mention the Beatles' drug use or their womanizing or their manager's homosexuality, for instance. And nowadays, I think we wouldn't see something like that, certainly in the United States.
And what about their relationship with the press? Because the media, the Stones didn't have a great relationship with them, did they?
Well, yes and no. I think there was a lot of performance that was going on. You know, in his autobiography, Keith Richards explained how the dynamic worked. The Stones would, act even more outrageous and insulting and impolite to journalists than they actually really felt, you know. And then in return, that seemed to boost their credibility with, you know, rebellious and disaffected young people. And so there's a kind of self-perpetuating cycle. The more parents disliked the Stones and the more authorities got on their case, the more it seemed to enhance their popularity. So since then, it's become a very well-known scam in the music industry.
We have this contest going on our WLR and Topical Currents Facebook page. Paul, why don't you come on and tell us if you have any results?
Well, we have just a few results right now, and actually it's about 3 or 4, and they're going for the Beatles. And I just wanted to mention, though, the direct link is facebook.com/topicalcurrents, and you'll see it right there.
Right. So you can also call in if you have an opinion. That's 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email us, radio@wlrn.org. One thing I was thinking about was how different their fan bases were at the beginning. It seemed, doesn't it break down by gender a lot? Were the Stones largely male while the Beatles were largely female?
Yeah, the Stones were actually one of the first pop acts of that era to attract a large and devoted male following. You know, until then, you know, guys would sometimes go see pop acts, but they would kind of stand in the back of the room and, you know, snigger and gawk, and they would just maybe show up as a courtesy to their dates or something. But the Stones drew a big male following, and in fact, at the very early shows, you know, guys would sort of muscle themselves up to the front of the stage and push the girls out of the way, which was unheard of at the time. And of course, the Beatles, you know, they were in England, they were popular with all levels of society. It was adults and politicians and even the British royal family, but their main fan base, of course, was girls, and it was actually very young girls. People sometimes forget how young their fan base was when they were first starting. It was girls between like maybe 11 and 14 years old.
And Mick Jagger presented, well, he still does, this rather androgynous image. Was that part of his appeal?
I think probably. This is speculation, and no one can say for sure. You know, there's one theory that I describe in the book that comes from another musician, and he just felt that, you know, Mick had this androgynous appeal and so men liked him in ways that were maybe deeply sublimated. And if you had asked any guy if they had any real attraction for Mick Jagger, they would have said no. But we know, the researchers now, there's a very popular theory that holds that, you know, sexual attraction exists on a kind of continuum. And so very few people are completely heterosexual or completely homosexual. Heterosexual people have had a gay thought or vice versa. And so this is the theory that was put across back then, and a lot of people think it holds some validity.
What was the Rolling Stones' first big gig that really put them on the map?
Well, I don't know if there's one big gig, but what they got was a residency at a place called the Crawdaddy Club, which was right outside of London. And this was a place where they played every Sunday night. And their idea was, instead of like going around town and scrounging for bookings, they would just play at the same place and try to attract a devoted following. And it happened very quickly. They became a cult sensation in England. They were the hot sort of almost underground band in the area. And people would just wait in line for hours to catch them at this club.
Do you have an email, Bonnie?
We just have an email. Stones all the way. No name. Just Stones all the way. All right.
Very succinct.
And yes. Let's take a call. This is Dave in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an amateur musician, play sax and bass, as far as the and I listen to the bass lines of both groups very, very carefully. Paul McCartney is the better of the two bassists, hands down. Now, as far as which of the two bands is concerned, I'll take the Beatles in the daytime, and I'll take the Stones at night. I'll take your comments off the air.
John McMillan, there isn't an apple and orange thing with the Beatles and the Stones.
Yeah, apple and orange. Yeah, well, yes, well, sure. They had a lot of things in common in the sense that they were the same age, they were coming out of England, and they were both inspired by, African American musicians. But they had different tastes, and the Beatles were really into Motown, and especially the girl groups from that era, like the Shirelles and the Ronettes and the Shangri-Las and so on. And as I mentioned before, the Stones were really into the gritty electric blues coming out of Chicago and Mississippi. And so that was, one of their main differences. And then getting back to the caller's point, though, you know, there's another very good book also called Beatles versus Stones by two rock critics called Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot are their names. And he really delves into the different aesthetic preferences that people may have and, you know, who had the better drummer, the better bass player, which was the better live act and so on. And I don't really deal with aesthetic questions in this book. I'm interested in those questions, but it's more of a joint biography where I try to talk about how the friendship and rivalry between the groups was constructed by fans and people in the media and so on. But I don't delve into those questions myself, although they're always fun to talk about.
We talk about this kind of tough image of the Rolling Stones, and Mick Jagger wrote Street Fighting Man. Paul, if you can put that up for us, that's number four. He wrote that after what event?
In 1968, there's a big protest in London at Grosvenor Square, if I'm pronouncing it correct. It was an anti-war protest, which he attended briefly, and then left and came back and wrote the lyrics to this song.
Fighting Man, kind of the rough edge of the Stones.
And then the Beatles, rough edge. Now, what do you write, John McMillan, what do you write that the revolution was about?
Well, it's an interesting song because the lyrics are somewhat at odds with its musical textures, but that was a song that was sort
got
of
me
a,
in,
a put,
out.
Well, right. Well, so it's interesting. The song was sort of a put down of the New Left militants, the people who were involved in street fighting, frankly, who championed a real politics of confrontation with the police and so on. And John Lennon seemed to endorse a more pacifistic approach, or he seemed to endorse the aesthetic radicalism of the counterculture. Although, as you point out, he seemed unsure of that as well. He says, there's a line in the song that says, when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? And then in one version of the song, not the version you played,
right,
he says, you can count me out in, because he says he couldn't decide whether he would be in favor of violence or not under some circumstances.
Reading your book, John McMillan, I found that you talked about that Lennon, of course, he was the give peace a chance and the bed in and all of that, love, love, love. And yet he could be quite a bully. He was anti-Semitic. And was he also homophobic?
Yeah, he was. I think he had a great capacity for personal growth, and sort of towards the end of his life, maybe under the influence of Yoko Ono, he would consider himself a feminist, and he wrote some lyrics or some poems, actually, opposed to homophobia. But when he was younger, he was a homophobic, anti-Semitic bully.
I mean, he wrote Imagine.
Yeah, so isn't that odd, that the shift in his thinking, at least, is expressed by the song?
What about their political involvement, or lack thereof? The Beatles, it seemed, appeared to have more, you know, involvement politically, socially, and even spiritually, with that whole thing with the Maharaja, George Harrison. So, and what about the Stones?
But Brian Jones played the sitar also.
Well, that's true, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. But was that just an illusion, or were either of them political?
Well, it's a complicated question, but, you know, as you suggested, the Beatles were clearly seen as generational leaders, and you know, as they began to embrace, you know, the counterculture and the love aesthetic and hippiedom and everything else, they had a big influence. But the counterculture was, in some respects, apolitical. The Beatles never got involved in any of the big political causes of their day. They didn't try to, you know, end atomic weapons, or they didn't actively crusade against the Vietnam War. They didn't try to end segregation. They had a different aesthetic. And so the idea of the Beatles being political is a bit complicated. And nor were the Stones involved in any political causes. When sort of revolution was briefly kind of faddish among young people in 68 and 69, they seemed to telegraph in various ways that they were supporting youth culture militants. But then again, they never got involved directly in any political causes or efforts.
It's interesting because you kind of, when you think about it, you realize they didn't, but they had the image that they were. I mean, you would kind of invoke the Beatles when you would think of, you know, political movements at the time.
Yeah, so, I mean, part of this was maybe marketing, in the sense that their manager, Brian Epstein, who died in 1967, before he died, he was very clear that he did not want the Beatles to be involved in any political controversy. And for the most part, you know, they acquiesced, but I think they found ways of telegraphing some of their views. And it was very much the same thing with the Stones. You know, they could provoke or present a very rebellious image without actually committing themselves to any concrete political agendas or reforms.
Of course, they had the Altamont and the Hell's Angel business that went on.
Sure. Well, that certainly enhanced their reputation as bad boys, didn't it?
What about drugs? Oh, I'm sorry, Jeff. What about drugs?
Let's talk drugs.
I mean, the Beatles openly embraced, you know, smoking pot and dropping acid.
Amphetamines and Hamburg.
Well, okay, so somewhat discrepant to what I just said, they did get involved in one issue, which is they spent money on a petition that appeared in a British newspaper supporting the legalization of marijuana, and they signed their names to it along with a bunch of other people. So that was one cause that they did get involved with. And then it was they made no real secret of the fact that they were taking LSD. They put that across first in their music, and the Beatles were very much at the forefront of taking psychedelic drugs. They were taking LSD in 1965 when a lot of people, you know, hadn't even figured out what marijuana smelled like.
Yourself in a boat on a river.
Thank you, John.
Let's take a quick call. This is Nancy in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm weighing in. I was raised much bigger Stones fan and grew to appreciate the Beatles later on in life because, to me, the Stones have always been more visceral. And so you kind of get this feeling from the Stones from listening to their music and it's a little bit more heavy with the Beatles, and it takes some time to sink in, and plus having older sisters telling you that the Beatles are the greatest thing ever doesn't necessarily help their cause. So I'm a bigger Stones fan, but have grown to appreciate the Beatles.
John?
Well, I think it's true that the Stones do seem more visceral to a lot of people, and the Beatles have maybe were more intellectually minded in their approach to a lot of their music, and so that's one of the dichotomies that I explore in the book. Although it's interesting, she said she started out liking the Stones and then grew to like the Beatles. Mm-hmm. I find with most people it's the opposite. Very young children love the Beatles and then maybe begin to appreciate them at a different level as they grow and become, you know, more intelligent. But the young people tend to love the Beatles, and people tend to grow to appreciate the Stones later on in most cases.
We're speaking with John McMillan. He's an author and assistant professor of history at Georgia State University. He's written Beatles versus Stones, and we want to hear from you on our Facebook page. It's topicalcurrents/Facebook. I'm sorry. It's Facebook/
You guys can't get that straight.
I can't get that straight.
How are we doing with that, Paul?
Facebook/topicalcurrents.
Well, it's coming along. We could get some more participation.
And the address is?
Oh, it is facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
Okay.
All right, let's take a short break on today's Topical Currents, and we'll be right back.
What a production landmark.
Yeah.
French horn.
But keep that on in the background because of the next part that it gets to, okay? John, so the Beatles in their much briefer career, what they accomplished musically versus the Stones, I know you said you didn't want to pick the bands apart, but weren't they really the trendsetters? Like, they did this, and then the Stones did their Satanic Majesty's Request?
Yeah, there were several moments in the two groups' careers where it seemed to a lot of people that the Stones were kind of glomming on to what the Beatles were doing or following the Beatles' creative lead. And so the Beatles had such tremendous success with Sgt. Pepper, which had, you know, such great fanfare. And then so the Stones, then that was a quasi-psychedelic record. And so the Stones came out later with their Satanic Majesty's Request, which was also an attempt at a psychedelic approach. And that didn't really suit the Stones. It was very dissimilar from what they'd been doing. And so a lot of people thought they were clearly trying to follow the Beatles' lead there.
And here's the great Ringo. Just a little off key.
And what about the other that you talk about first? Well, but you say something different. So first there was Yesterday, number 3.
Well, we're keeping Paul busy.
We're keeping Paul busy.
Thank you very much.
That's George speaking.
We'd like to carry on now with a song from our new album in England, and it'll be out in America shortly. And it's a song featuring just Paul. And it's called Yesterday. Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly,
No wonder they stopped performing live.
There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know. She wouldn't say.
The most covered song of all time.
Is it?
Love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
So how long after yesterday did Mick Jagger come out with
As Tears Go By. Yeah.
Marianne
Well, the interesting
Faith.
Thing is, As Tears Go By was actually written first. It was one of the first songs that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards wrote together. Do you want me to keep talking?
Go ahead.
And this was a quietly strummed acoustic ballad, and they felt that this didn't suit the Stones. They definitely weren't going to take this to the rest of the band because it wasn't the type of music the Stones were recording. But then the Beatles came out with Yesterday, which was a huge hit, and it had Paul McCartney and a quietly strummed guitar, and in the recorded version there's a string arrangement. And after the Beatles' success, the Stones changed their mind and they decided to release As Tears Go By as a single, and it likewise featured only Mick Jagger, none of the other band members, and a guitar and a string arrangement.
So listen.
I want to hear the children sing. All I hear is the sound of rain falling on the ground. I sit and watch as tears go by.
And how was that received when they came out with that?
Well, it was a huge hit for the Stones over here in the United States. It was they released it right before Christmas, and they had a lot of success with it. But John Lennon certainly felt this was another example of the Stones just, you know, clearly imitating what the Beatles were doing.
Would you say the Stones were actually more competitive with the Beatles than vice versa?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we talk about the Beatles and the Stones being rivals, but in one sense, that's a misnomer because the Beatles always sold many more records than the Stones by a huge margin. And I think the Stones resented the commercial success of the Beatles as well as their cultural influence. And they really seem to be fixated on the rivalry more so than the Beatles. If you read a lot of the memoirs and interviews that the Stones have given over the years, they're always talking about, you know, being seen with the Beatles or hanging out with them or being compared to them or performing with them or whatnot. But if you look at the Beatles material, they're not always really obsessing on what the Stones were doing.
John, in the book, you talk about when the Beatles, all four of them came to see the Stones in performance. They were wearing these leather coats and they knew that they were the real king of the walk, and the Stones were very intimidated by it.
Yeah, that's right. The Beatles at that point, they had a couple big hits in England. So Beatlemania had not quite, you know, hit full force, but they were a hot band in England. And the Stones were still a club act playing at that club I mentioned earlier. And the Beatles had just arrived in London from Liverpool, and they didn't know their way around, but someone had recommended the Stones. And so they went and checked them out, and they enjoyed their set, and the Stones were nervous and a little bit odd to be playing right in front of the Beatles. And then afterwards, they hung out till 4 a.m, and that was the first time they really socialized, and they seem to get along pretty well.
We have an emailer that says, when we mentioned the Fuzzbox, well, Joe mentioned Sound of the Riffin, the song Satisfaction. Please verify with your guest. According to Keith Richards, in a past interview on NPR, the way it was recorded was Keith using a handheld cassette recorder and played it on acoustic guitar. If you listen to the original recording, you can hear it.
Yeah, in Keith's memoirs, Keith Keith Richards' memoir, Life, he talks in great detail about the recording of some of those songs, and I think the callers or emailer is correct.
And didn't Keith Richards also write that song? Didn't he say he had a dream or something? I think I heard the interview with Terry Gross,
well,
he's
an incredible fibber, so it's hard to say. But yeah, he says it came to him in the middle of the night and he woke up and played the chords. Paul McCartney has said the same thing about his song Yesterday, that it came to him in a dream and he woke up and there was a piano and the melody was just right there. I don't know if that's true or not. There's so many fibs in Keith's book.
The other thing I was thinking is there were so many groups that imitated the Beatles, and you write about this, but the Stones, did anybody try to emulate the Stones?
I think the best example is a British group called the Pretty Things, which is a really neat band that sounded a lot like the Stones, and then there were some other more minor acts that were doing kind of a Stones type thing. You know, but the Beatles had a huge influence on not just the Stones, but on everybody. It's a little unfair to pick on the Stones for following the Beatles' creative lead because they certainly weren't the only ones to do that.
Mm-hmm. Where did Led Zeppelin fit into this?
People always ask me about Led Zeppelin. I really don't know what to say because they came along a bit later, and I'm not as big a fan or I'm not super knowledgeable about the groups, but a lot of people have advised me that my whole conception is wrong, that it should be Led Zeppelin versus every other band.
I used to work as a DJ and I always get these late night calls, hey man, can you play Stairway to Heaven?
I ran into Robert Plant on my 35th birthday in Cambridge. He just walked into the bar where I was at and we had a neat little chat. Some of it's probably not suitable for National Public Radio consumption.
Right. How about their performances? Who gave the better performance, or is that even measurable?
It's not measurable because the Beatles they were probably best as a live act before they were famous. When they were a club band in Hamburg and also in Liverpool, these shows haven't been recorded, but they had an incredibly vast repertoire. So they were doing all types of many different types of music, but they really kind of specialized in souped up American rock and roll, Chuck Berry songs and so on, and they were known for playing those songs sort of louder and faster and harder than a lot of bands, and they put on some memorable shows according to people who witnessed them, but we can't hear them. The Stones, of course, had Mick Jagger as a front man, and they went on to do these very sensational tours, and they were a lot more they have a great reputation as a live act. It's almost unsurpassed,
and they're still doing it, and we need to take a break. We're speaking with John McMillan. He's an author and assistant professor of history at Georgia State University, and his book is Beatles versus Stones. You can still vote at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Breasts, drugs. Oh.
So put that song in context for us, John. Let it bleed.
I'm not sure that I can. The lyrics in that live version that you just played are a little bit different from the lyrics that are recorded, which are a little more suggestive.
It's more up tempo also.
Yeah, it's a different version of the song that most people are familiar with. And once again, we're delving into, if you really want me to to analyze the song, we'd be delving into material that MPR
well, maybe we
should want
then.
Well, Al wants to know if you can address the prolificness of the Beatles versus the Stones.
You know, when the Beatles had, you know, from the time they recorded their first record until their last record, I think it was about almost a little more than 7 years, and they were incredibly prolific. At first, it was because they felt that Beatlemania was a fad. There was simply no precedent before the Beatles for a group to grow older and mature and then attract a more adult following. And so before Beatlemania died out, they were just trying to make as much money as they could. And then later on, they slowed down a bit, but still, they had such incredible creative energy.
The way they cranked out those songs for the movies, too. Wow.
Yeah, they were incredibly prolific, and the Stones were, you know, as well for a very long time. They slowed down a bit, you know, certainly recently. But the Stones are also a very hardworking and prolific band. The Stones have outlasted the Beatles for a long time.
I think Keith was 70 yesterday.
Is that right?
Or Thursday.
I saw another news report recently that Mick Jagger is now a great-grandfather, I believe.
Oh, my God. Oh, yes. I saw that, too. What about the Beatles' breakup? Do you think that had an effect on their, you know, you say cast this mystique of sorts, mm-hmm. which perhaps is responsible for their longevity because of their breakup?
Well, you know, when the Beatles broke up in 1970, they never shared a stage again. They never recorded another song. There was always a lot of discussion about a possible Beatles reunion, but they never had one. And, you know, so as a result, they broke up when they were still very young, and they were very much near the height of their creative power. And so they do have a certain mystique around them as a result. And the Stones, of course, carried on. And they had a great run in the late 60s and early 70s when they put together some of their very best records. But, you know, after Exile on Main Street in 1972, a lot of people noticed a decline in the quality of their work. And yet they kept chugging along, and they've perhaps diluted their catalog with some, you know, many mediocre records. And of course, they've gotten older, and some people think they seem a little silly out there at their age. And so, you know, if the Stones had broken up in 1972 without ever playing together again, I wonder if they would have some of the same mystique as the Beatles.
Did they ever, was there any ever talk of their breakup, breaking up?
Of
the Stones breaking up?
Yeah, they came very close a couple times. The first time was in the mid to late 70s when there was a lot of drugs in the band and petty rivalry and squabbling within the group and police prosecution and so on. And then there was a longer period when Mick Jagger and Keith Richards just seemed to, you know, really hate each other's guts in the 1980s. And so Mick did some solo records that the others resented and so on.
Do we want to...
You want to hear Hey Jude or Can't Always Get What You Want?
John?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Hey Jude.
Okay.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad.
Take a sad song. Written about John Lennon's son, of course. Bonnie's doing the harmony. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better. And any time you feel the pain, hey Jude. A great drum roll there. Don't carry
the world. Great song. John, I want to talk about this book in the context of your other books, because this actually grew out of your interest in the underground press, and it's like an offshoot, you said, of your book, Smoking Typewriters, the 60s Underground Press and the Rise of Alternative Media in America. So how did this Beatles versus Stones grow out of that?
Well, my first book was very different from this in the sense that it was, you know, a scholarly monograph. It was based on my dissertation at Columbia University. But I was writing about this vast network of, you know, radical tabloids in the late 60s and early 70s. And I don't know how many of your listeners will remember, but, you know, there were these new left and countercultural papers all across the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then we had alluded to in 1968, there was this big ideological debate among youth culture aficionados between regarding the Beatles and the Stones and which band had the kind of correct political analysis. And I thought that was so interesting. And people have always said that there's no real new source material that any historians can deal with regarding the Beatles and the Stones, that everything had been picked over. But these underground newspapers had never figured in any analysis of either group. And so I wrote an essay that led to the book. But this book is meant for a more popular audience. It's supposed to be a delightful, enjoyable book for people to read.
What's your favorite Beatles song? What's your favorite Stones song? Is it like picking between
song?
Kids?
No, I have favorites for both groups. My favorite Beatles song is A Day in the Life, and my favorite Stones song is Gimme Shelter.
Mm-hmm. And the essay that you wrote, I'm interested to know, what did you say in the essay about the two groups? I mean, if you can summarize it.
Sure. Well, we've picked over it just a little bit. I was trying to draw attention to just how seriously young people took the music of that era. I don't think we'll see anything, you know, like it again. I said that the Beatles and the Stones weren't terribly political, and yet, you know, young people were scrutinizing their records for hidden meanings or messages or ideas about how they should style themselves politically or live their lives and everything else. They were just absolutely obsessed with the messages that these bands were sending. And so that was the point I was trying to get across. And a lot of that is in the book as well.
So Paul McCartney wasn't dead.
No.
We have an emailer. David in North Miami Beach says the Beatles were built around four-part choral music, the Rolling Stones around Mick Jagger, and Alan Parsons worked at Abbey Road.
I can't comment on that.
I guess not. Well,
it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Yes.
John McMillan.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation, so thanks for having me.
We'll have a link. Do you have a website, by the way?
It's under construction, but it's johnmcmillan.com. Give me a couple more weeks.
Okay, and it's McMillian, actually, the spelling. It's McMillian.
Yeah, there's a silent I.
Yes, thanks. And we'll have a link to your book, Beatles versus Stones, on our website, WLRN.org.
And also on the Facebook page.
And, Paul, do we have a reading on the poll?
It is a dead heat.
All right.
How fitting.
The name of the book?
Happy Holidays.
Beatles versus Stones. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
And yes, indeed, thanks for joining us. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And you can vote Beatles versus Stones. Tomorrow's program is on Christmas Eve, of course. We'll speak with religious scholar Riza Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Not Bethlehem? Now to the calendar. On this day in 1943, 70 years ago, the birth of the multi-talented Harry Shearer in Los Angeles. His radio pedigree goes back to a kid's role in the old Jack Benny radio show. Of course, he does many voices on The Simpsons, including Mr. Burns and the pious Nedward Flanders. And on this day in 1948, 65 years ago, the execution of Japanese Prime Minister Hideki Tojo for war crimes. He had earlier botched a suicide attempt. And one more while we just get the facts, ma'am. On this day in 1982, 31 years ago, the death of early TV's Joe Friday from the Dragnet series, Jack Webb. He was once married to Julie London. His badge number was 714. Among his TV cop partners was veteran actor Harry Morgan. So we leave with a thought from Harry Shearer, who co-wrote and co-starred in This Is Spinal Tap, quote, "If absolute power corrupts absolutely, does absolute powerless make you poor? Pure." I don't know. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, always a pleasure to be with you. Here and now from NPR News, up next.
They were
picture yourself in a boat on a...